Hello, Dubatters. I've just finished this interview with Troy. It goes in a few directions, actually. We talk about his Paralympic experience and it being such a successful wheelchair basketball player. But actually, towards the end, I think what was really fascinating about this is not only just understanding some of the challenges of being an adaptive runner and an amputee runner, but actually hearing about the conversations that he's had or he's having with organizations such as UTMB, Golden Trail. And there were some quite controversial views in there. Some of them being, for example, that just because you've qualified for UTMB, he doesn't think necessarily amputee athletes should therefore be able to do UTMB if they haven't done 100 miler already. And understanding how some of the issues with the challenges with you can set rules and you can try and be as embracing of runners with disabilities, but if that doesn't flow through all of the stewards, and actually if you don't think about how you need to change the rules at aid stations and various other points in races, how while you can try and be inclusive, you're still not being. So a really interesting episode. Take it away, Nick.
They're bad, they're boys, and occasionally they talk about running. Yes, it's the Bad Boy Running Podcast with your hosts, Jody Rainsford and David Heller. Come back, baby, come back.
With a bye, 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 with a bye, 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 bye. I must admit I was a clone to be messing around, but that doesn't mean that you have to leave.
So, Dubatters, we like to bring you the best stories from around the world. And our next guest is someone who has spanned many sports, but most recently defines himself more as a trail runner, having been the first person as an amputee to finish a 100K UTMB event. Previous to that, though, he's been into the Paralympic Games from 92 to 2008, where he won 3 medals for wheelchair basketball. So to tell us about his experience, but also how trail running has changed his connection with sport and also his focus on winning and how it no longer is everything for him. Welcome to the podcast, the wonderful Troy Sachs. Hooray!
G'day, g'day. How are you going?
Yeah, really good, really good. We've spent a long time not recording this, haven't we? The last few months just trying to figure out how we can do this from different time zones. So it's great to finally have you on. So where are you currently based?
I'm based in Sydney, Australia. It's currently summer here, so it's hot and humid, which is not really great for pounding the pavement, but you know, it's good for losing weight.
Yeah, I bet. Even if it's just water retention, which is so come winter, you balloon again. Well, should we start at the beginning then? With people who are amputees, some people are born amputees, some people have accidents, some people develop issues. What's your story?
I was born with a deformed foot at the in 1975. And the deformed foot was because the fibula hadn't developed properly. I had what I called a duck's flipper, amputated when I was 2.5, which left me with basically my tibia. So I've still got my heel. So I've still got a really good end-bearing stump to put inside the socket that then is attached to the artificial foot to move and to run and to jump and to do all those sort of things. And you know, as you did mention, there are two types of amputees. You're either acquire your amputation or your artificial limb, whether it be arm or leg or any other parts, or you have a birth defect. So, mine was a birth defect, and at the age of 2.5, had it amputated. And you can probably imagine, you know, back in 1977, there wasn't much technology around. So my first artificial leg was made by my father, who's a German immigrant, and he made my first artificial leg just out of plaster and some Velcro straps. And then when I got to about 3 or 4, I was started to see a prosthetist to get a properly fitted artificial leg. So my walking wasn't the best, but you know, back in those days, it's sort of, you know, have a can of harden up and get outside and cracking on.
Because before then, up to the age of 2.5, because you know, most kids are starting to walk around 1, 1.5.
Yep.
What did your movement been?
So my movement was, I was still able to ambulate or walk around, but because of the leg discrepancy in the length, it was very awkward. And as soon as the foot was gone and I was placed with my, you know, let's say transition limb, you know, I was out and about. You know, there was, my mother told me a story that apparently when I came out of the surgery, I actually took off the plaster cast to see if it was gone. And when I saw that it was gone, she said I was just so elated because, you know, I'm a very active individual. I could never sit still through school. You know, all my school reports say, you know, too active, can't sit still, can't do this, can't, you know. So for me, it was all about outside and getting my hands dirty and moving around. So having the deformed foot amputated just actually opened up the entire world. And I have a brother that's 2.5 years old. So, you know, he's still my biggest competitor. And he took no quarter. You know, he unleashed his almighty hell on me growing up, as usually a big brother does to a little brother. So I think, you know, having my disability in the late 70s, early 80s was kind of a blessing in disguise, because there was no pain medication. There was no, you know, poor little boy sit in the corner and relax. It was all about, you know, sucking the marrow out of life.
So then, when you did you have to relearn to walk and to run? And what is your running style like? What was your running style like?
So when I was younger, I would say my running style wasn't the best, because the artificial leg was very heavy. Like compared to what they are now, some of them were actually made out of wood and just shaped, and you just had a normal wooden foot that was just shaped with a hammer and a mallet. So it was very archaic and they were very heavy. And I've only lost basically my foot, you know, but I had a leg that actually went all the way up past my knee when I was a kid. So, you know, agility wasn't really my strong point. So it was very cumbersome, very sort of, you know, I played soccer, but I played in the goals, you know, so I could run and I could jump as a teenager, but that came later as the technology came. And I kind of think that if I was around this time, you know, I don't really think that my wheelchair basketball would have happened. I think that running would have taken its sort of time with me because of the technology. But the technology wasn't around when I first started playing wheelchair basketball with artificial legs. So me jumping in a wheelchair was actually instant freedom. You know, I have a 7-foot wingspan. So, you know, I'm 6'4". So it was actually just instant freedom away from the leg, you know, having the leg off. Because, you know, you get blisters, just like when you wear a new pair of shoes, you get blisters on your stump. So there's a lot of stump care that's involved. And when you're a kid, you don't really care for yourself that much until it gets bad enough that you show mum and dad, you know. So I guess my running style was very cumbersome, kind of like a Tyrannosaurus Rex, you know, the arms in the front, short steps. And I wouldn't say that I enjoyed running. You know, it was definitely not something that I looked forward to, something that I tried to get away from because of the lack of the energy return from the artificial leg.
So did you was the wheelchair just for sport, for wheelchair basketball then, or was it also something you'd use day to day at times? Or
never? No, I basically was always on my artificial leg. I would fall asleep in it sometimes. You know, and I'm sure people are scratching their head. We don't shower with our artificial leg on. We don't bathe with it on. We take it off. But if you're really tired as a kid, sometimes kids fall asleep in their food. You know, I fell asleep with my leg on. My wheelchair was only ever used for sport. It was an avenue to play sport in. It was a piece of sporting equipment for me. I never used the wheelchair to get around in the streets or around at school. You know, that sort of stuff. I did, to learn to push the wheelchair, I did push my wheelchair to high school and back when other kids rode their push bikes, but that was only to build up stamina, resistance, and understand how the wheelchair works better.
So then how did that come about then? Were you Were you recruited to a team, or did your family or yourself think, I'd like to do that as an opportunity, or?
Yeah, the pathway to wheelchair basketball was via a lot of able-bodied sports. My father was a huge soccer fan, so I played soccer up until I was about 13, and played it, made some representative teams in goals. I love playing goalkeeper because, again, you don't have to run that far. You could jump, you could dive. And I had a soccer accident, so I was in a bad tackle and broke my kneecap on my artificial leg side. So when I was in hospital, a person in a wheelchair that played wheelchair basketball was going through the wards saying g'day to people, and he saw my artificial leg, and that was around 1990. And amputees have just been accepted to play wheelchair basketball at the Paralympics, so they were obviously recruiting. And he said, why don't you come along and give it a go? And obviously my knee wasn't – I wasn't going to be wearing my artificial leg for a number of weeks because of the injury I sustained. And I tell you what, as soon as I sat in that wheelchair, it was just like a light bulb. It just went off, and I was like, wow, like this is cool. And that's where my love with moving the chair and doing the things that I started to think about and do from there. So, you know
– What was that? Was that freedom? Was that – what was the emotion?
I think the emotion number one was automatically from my belly button up was not maimed. It wasn't affected. And basically it was strong enough to push the wheelchair no matter how good or bad the wheelchair was. Whereas I felt from my belly button down, with the lack of technology that had gone into artificial legs, it didn't allow me to be free, or the mobility that I was after, and the mobility that I felt with the wheelchair, you know, the zigzagging, the speed, you know, and also too the contact. Like the contact in wheelchair basketball was just, it just spoke my language, you know, and I wasn't great at the sport. You know, no one ever just picks up something and they're awesome at it. You know, everything takes hard work. But I think, you know, consciously and subconsciously it was like, wow, this is just fantastic.
And because you've had a very successful career as a wheelchair basketball player, like that, that surprises me, because I wouldn't have thought there'd be enough money in wheelchair basketball until maybe the last 6-7 years, let alone from the 90s onwards. So is that because there was a very established league in Australia? Is that because of the Paralympics or?
So my pathway into, let's say, the top echelon of wheelchair basketball was at the age of 15, I made my first Paralympic Games in 1992. So, you know, I went to the Paralympic Games and played and felt quite comfortable with playing the game at that level. I was then recruited from that tournament. I was recruited to an American university to take up a scholarship and play in the university system. So I didn't finish high school. I trekked straight off to University of Wisconsin. And don't forget, this was 1993, so there was no email. So there was no way of them checking, you know, records or anything like that. I sat the SAT exam, and I didn't like the questions. So I actually wrote an exam on the back of the paper. That's how this exam was culturally biased. To foreigners, because we don't know what the Pony Express is. And they accepted me in a university. It helps to play wheelchair basketball. And from then, it gave me an opportunity to train full time. You know, being a student athlete, and I was training the 6 hours a day that we were allowed to train. And from there, I sort of started to grow physically. You know, I was 6'4" when I was about 14, but I was, you know, 75 kilos. Between, you know, 94 and 96, I ended up putting on, you know, close to 20 kilos of muscle. And you know, at the 96 Paralympic Games, after training in college for 2 years, you know, the Australian team won the gold medal. I shot a world record 42 points in the final, which is still a world record in Olympic and Paralympic sports. So not even Michael Jordan or, you know, Kobe Bryant, they don't have that record. So...
Is it the same point scoring system?
Yep. 2 points is 2 points. 3 points is 3 points. A foul shot is a foul shot. The basket is 10 feet tall. The court is 94 feet long and I think 28 feet wide, something like that. So it's exactly the same court. And I think, you know, I can feel my father turning over his grave because he taught us that you never talk about yourself. You know, you let other people talk about you. So, but, you know, after scoring that 42 points as a 19-year-old, I was offered a professional contract to play for the Dallas Wheelchair Mavericks, which is an NBA affiliate.
Yeah.
And you know, from there, I started my professional career. But I always had these dreams in my head of playing in Europe because I'd heard of, you know, the famous Spanish league. The Italian league was strong. There was a couple of Americans that I played with that had played in Europe before. And so I stayed in the US for a couple of years. We had the Paralympics in Sydney. And then after Sydney, I was offered a contract to play in Italy. And from there, it sort of just snowballed. And I guess...
So the Italian and Spanish leagues stronger than the American leagues?
Yes, they're stronger because they're professional. And when I say professional, they pay players more money. I think there's more philanthropic interest in sport for people with disabilities throughout Europe. And at big clubs like in Turkey, Fenerbahçe and Galatasaray have wheelchair affiliate clubs. You know, in Italy, they have a number of people that have clubs. You know, the guy that I played for in Italy, he imported wood veneer for Land Rover. So he put the wood veneer in Land Rovers and supplied IKEA with wood veneer. So, you know, the Spanish leagues are so famous and big because they have the UNCI Foundation, which is the lotteries, you know, and they're I think they're 2% of the national income. So it's, you know, there's ways that they have. And when you're at the top of your game, you're able to negotiate, you know, certain ways. And I early on, I had some, I call them mentors of not what I wanted to be. You know, they were awesome wheelchair basketballers and great athletes, but they didn't have the knack of negotiating and looking post-sport. You know, for me, I was always preparing, okay, well, when I can't do this, I've got to have something to fall back on, whether it be some money or some money to start a business. And I studied. So I sort of studied exercise physiology and you know, the human body and different ways of training and things like that. So I was always thinking of how better to become, you know, higher, faster, stronger, that sort of stuff.
And while we're still talking basketball, are the skills vastly different for if you took someone like a Jordan or a Shaq or a Kobe Bryant, put them in a wheelchair, would they also adapt quite quickly, or are there very different needs?
I played with a guy in college named Eric Barber, and he played Jordan one-on-one at his high school. So it was a make-a-wish thing, and Eric was, I think, his 6-0 up, and then Jordan came back because he figured it out. I think athletes and people that are successful, they'll figure out a way of how they can do something very, very quickly because that's why they're successful. You know, and I just feel that, yes, they might not be the best at it, but they'll find a way to be successful or be good and work things out because there's a reason why they're at the top of their game in their field.
So did Jordan win that game?
No, he lost by one. he lost by one and he was pissed too. He was not a happy camper. but also too, an athlete's an athlete. And I think it's, you know, everyone says being professional is being paid, but I actually consider I was a professional before I was getting paid because I had a mindset. I had a mindset of what I wanted to do. I was able to map it out. I was able to develop a ladder of goals to climb up and sequentially achieve those goals that would help me get better and stronger and think about, I guess, intellectualize the gym when, you know, you're meant to be lifting, you know, benching 130 kilo because it's wheelchair basketball is a power sport. It's all about two pushes, you know, but then it's also about being able to shoot, you know, long distances. So there was many different energy systems that I had to use and had to work on. And because of my involvement in exercise physiology, universities and playing at some teams that had able-bodied athletes that I was able to look at their ways. You know, I worked out ways on how to train plyometrically in a wheelchair, towing things, making the wheelchair heavier with sandbags, that sort of thing. So, you know, the pathway to wheelchair basketball was through able-bodied sport and an injury. And you know, as you said, 5 Paralympic Games, 2 golds, a silver, a couple of Hall of Fames, you know, later. You know, I found myself in 2000 and
well, what were the highlights, like the standout moments of Paralympics?
I think the highlights, obviously, are winning a gold medal. See, winning a gold medal at 19 is a highlight, but it was also a shackle. It was a shackle or an expectation that every single game I played from then on, I was expected to score 40 points. And I was expected to win because we did it and I came through under pressure. So it was a highlight because Australia had never won a basketball medal at the Olympics or Paralympics. It was also the games before the Olympics and Paralympics in Sydney in 2000. So the hype was just, you know, it just ramped it up another sort of, you know, another 100%. I would say that 20 years on from Athens, where we were given the silver medal. Now, in team sport, just don't forget, when you play for a gold medal, there's only 2 teams on the field. So we lost the gold. We didn't win the silver, in my mind. Yeah. But 20 years on, I would say that silver medal, you know, has so much more meaning now, and it taught me so many more lessons that I'm using in my trail running than what winning in 96 and winning in 2008. Now, winning in 2008 would be, I think, after my children being born, my second biggest highlight, because I came back from 2 shoulder reconstructions to make the team. And I wasn't playing that well during the tournament. It was only semi-final and final that I sort of came out of my shell and then played quite well. You know, and I would say that my biggest highlight was being inducted into the Australia Sport Hall of Fame, you know, it has nothing to do with Paralympic sport or even Olympic sport. It's Australia sport. I'm the 4th Paralympian only to be inducted, I think the 3rd basketballer, and to be acknowledged by my peers, you know, in Australia and at the UK, cricket's huge, you know, so... You know, with guys like Ricky Ponting and sort of, you know, the captains of our great test teams all there and our fantastic America's Cup team there and all these amazing able-bodied athletes and their families acknowledging, I guess, what I did mattered. And I think that will go down as being my biggest sporting moment, because when you're a Paralympian, you play your hardest and you compete against who is there, but the population base is smaller. And it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean any less. But when you go into those sorts of fields or that arena, like a Sport Australia Hall of Fame, it just becomes that much more, you know, credibility that my career is actually on par with our greats in Australia. And also too, like Dawn Fraser, she's an Australian icon in swimming, and for her to give me a hug and have tears and to say it's about time or welcome, it's like it's goosebump stuff. It's like, wow.
And when you're picking up the medal or you're at these ceremonies, is there almost an expectation that you should be in your chair, or does it not matter in terms of
No, you wheel out in your chair, because there's a lot of confusion with the classification system. And you know, when I played in America, we only had, out of the 10 players, we actually only had 3 that needed to sit down. So the classification system is different in every country, but internationally it's sort of developed that, you know, you have a point system. There's 14 points total for 5 players. And the 1-point player would be an individual that's paralyzed from the chest down. So their balance or their ability to maneuver the wheelchair or have balance is less than what an amputee is. So therefore, we have five players, 14 points. Mm. So in Australia, we usually play 2 4.5s, a 2.5, a 1.5, and a 1. So even within our own sport, we have a quality where not all amputees are playing at once. So that's how they make it, I guess, some people say fair, but I say, well, it's just equality because you want everyone with a disability to have the opportunity to play the sports.
Does that make it tricky for substitutions then? Because you almost have to match.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's usually platoon subs. So you very rarely do one for one. You sort of have two or three because you have different combinations with different points. And when you get into the nitty-gritty of it, you know, you start looking for a two-pointer that can actually play above his points, or a two-pointer that can sit as tall as what a 4.5 can. So you're trying to find your advantages within the whole classification system. So, yeah, you sort of, you know, and you can play under if you like. You can play 11 points if you like, if you think that that's stronger than your 14 points. Mm.
And you played at Galatasaray for one, two seasons. Do they have kind of diehard ultra hooligan basketball fans as well?
Yeah, they are. You know, wherever you traveled, there would be buses following you or Galatasaray fans meeting you with flares in the airport. So it's you know, when you play a local rival like Fabinache, it's a bit scary for someone that comes from Sydney, you know, that doesn't have that tribalism. You know, we have supporters, but you know, that's tribalism. Like it's DNA. It's generations of people supporting the same team, and it's their life kind of revolves around it. You know, and there's obviously the Netflix show, is it, you know, Wrexham or whatever, and I think people understand that has helped people understand the tribalism or the generational support that goes towards teams. Like in Melbourne, we have it with AFL. But it's not as fierce, it's not as intense as what that is. So it was very interesting for me. You know, I played sort of one season full there, and then I flew in for certain games from Australia and for the Europeans and stuff like that. So it was an experience, and you know, it was I guess the fans, when I start to play, I don't hear anything, so really it doesn't affect me. You know, I go into my own little world, and for me it was cutthroat. It was about getting a certain amount of points, a certain amount of rebounds, because that's the bonuses. You know, it was all about, I played for Australia for love, but then everywhere else I played, you know, for my livelihood.
So actually your financial bonuses are based on your personal scoring?
Some of them, yes. So I'd, you know, my whole... You know, I thought of every single way that I could leverage what I had. You know, I had scoring bonuses, rebound bonuses. I sometimes even had minutes bonuses that, you know, and then sometimes even you would go and say, well, okay, well, I'll run the strength and conditioning for the team, you know, that sort of stuff. So for me, it was always about gaining the most or sucking the most out of the team financially, but then also saying, well, okay, well, I can give back to the team because I know I've got more skills than what this person does and this person. Then when I leave, I can hopefully upskill this person on strength and conditioning for individuals with disabilities, you know, because and that's what I decided to really focus on and really hone in on, because that's what I love to do, you know, changing the way that I trained. Because when you get to the certain point, you're only looking for half percenters, you know, and those half percenters, if you can find 0.5% in strength, 0.5% in speed, and 0.5% in endurance, well, that's 1.5%. 1.5% for when you're at the top of your game, like a Kipchoge or someone like that, that's an enormous amount of improvement, you know. And so you might not even be looking. You might be looking for 0.5% overall, you know. And then you just want to maintain that for as long as possible.
Okay.
Yeah, so basically when I got to a certain point with strength and speed and ability, then it was more about then trying to look at, okay, well, how can I improve my intelligence? So my basketball IQ or my wheelchair basketball IQ. And then I started to watch videos of the game, slow them down, and then break them up and started to develop plyometric moves that would help the moves in the wheelchair to actually make myself faster.
Interesting. So when did you start to run and actually not just run, but race?
Yep. So my transition to running came in the form of I'd finished playing wheelchair basketball, and I was training a client, and he said he was going to go into this event that was over 48 hours, which is 100 kilometers. And I was thinking, like, man, I don't really think you can do that, but I could. So I put a team together, and my brother and my son's godfather, and we went out and had a crack, and it took us 29 hours. And during that metamorphosis of the brain that happens, and also too, I was still in my cutthroat, like, I'm the shit athlete, you know, like, I'm the king, I can do anything type mentality. And I think during that time, during that 29 hours and the damage that I did to my body and stump, because I wouldn't say I prepared too intelligently for it, you know.
Did you get a different foot for running? Or?
No, I didn't have anything different. I used basically what I use every day, because I said to myself, well, it's 48 hours, you know. If you travel 5Ks an hour, that's 20 hours, not a problem, easy peasy. You know, but I didn't know anything about nutrition, how many calories an hour. Like, we were eating sausage sandwiches and meat pies and soft drinks. And, you know, really, it broke me down to my bare minimum. And what I learned from that one race was that whether you're playing for a gold medal or you're just a layman having a crack, it still takes planning. And it still takes effort, and it still takes training. And whether you call training playing or whatever. So I guess for me, it actually provided me with an opportunity to say, well, okay, well, my legs haven't been used for 20-odd years because I played wheelchair basketball. I really like doing this. I need to do some other things now to figure out how I can make my stump stronger. So I actually went and designed my own running blade and got a boat builder, and we built a carbon running blade that was for the trails, and worked with my prosthetist on better sockets, and then, you know, started to do a lot of lunges and a lot of squats and a lot of balance work. And the next year we did the same race and we finished in 24 hours and 55 minutes. But I was the only one that didn't get injured. Yet the year before, all of us got injured, but the year after, you know, the next one, And then I started to obviously look around, and we have Ultra Trail Australia in Australia in the Blue Mountains. And I started to do a little research, and there was not an amp that's had done it before. And I was like, well, I'm going to try and train. And this was around the COVID time. So, you know, when COVID hit, it got postponed, which gave me an extra 12 months to really nut down and work out what I need to do. And during that race at the 55-kilometer mark, the race director said, you need to have a doctor with you. You need to obviously have your crew. And so when I saw my crew at 55K, I changed my artificial leg and the liner, and my doctor was looking at my stump, and he said, you fractured your tibia. And I was like, well, it hurts a little bit. So, and he said, so he put some anesthetic cream on it, and 62K was the next checkpoint. So I saw him and he said, how does it feel? I said, man, it feels like a broken leg. So, and he said, well, you can't do any more damage. So I end up withdrawing.
Was he right in that?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant if you continue, it couldn't get any worse. But he's saying
no, it could. The pain could. The pain did get worse, you know. But you know, it took me to a different place, and it was a similar achievement to winning a gold medal. But what the achievement was it wasn't, I still won a gold medal, but I wasn't presented with a gold medal. You know, going internally and working stuff out or working through a problem, you know, I focus on 1 meter squared. That's all I focus on is 1 meter squared. And how do I get, you know, left foot, right peg, left foot, right peg. You know, that was the whole motto. And for me, it was only pain. You know, it was pain. And my whole life, I'd suffered pain in some form or another. But I thought about all my able-bodied counterparts out on the trail, and they were suffering just as much as I was. You know, they might not have had a fractured tibia, but they were still facing their own type of pain. You know, so for me, finishing, you know, getting to 92 kilometers and then sort of saying that's enough, I sort of withdrew, and because I felt that I'd pushed my limit. And I was very, very content. So The metamorphosis in my, I guess, competitive nature from being cutthroat in basketball and win at all costs because my livelihood depended on it, to being in a trail race and doing 50-odd kilometres or 40-odd kilometres with a broken tibia, it was I likened it to being the same, but I felt more content. I felt more at peace with my effort because I couldn't have done any more. And that's when I first started to realize that I hear people talk about doing their personal bests, especially individual athletes. They say, I got a PB today. And then the commentator would say, yeah, you won a gold medal. He said, yeah, but I got a PB. So even if I didn't win the gold medal, I would be disappointed I didn't win the gold medal, but I'd be still happy because I got a PB. You know, and I think that I kind of became human in a way, like less robotic, and it taught me a lot from where I've gone to now with how I train, how I develop my stump, how I, you know, fuel the races I enter, how I now have a leg runner. You know, I have instead of a pacer, I have a leg runner. So they actually, on big races, they carry a spare leg in their pack.
Oh, interesting.
Because if I would have had that during that first 55 kilometers, I don't think I would have fractured my tibia because I would have changed my center of gravity and I would have changed the contact point in a different socket.
So actually, they are different. It's not a replacement like for like. They're different. No. And is that for uphill, downhill?
Like a model. They're still made like a model around your stump. And then they're sort of packed and shaped with plaster of Paris, and then they're covered with fiberglass so you slip into it. So it's kind of like getting it to, let's say, the different shoes you use for, you know, your tempo, your long run. You know, you might have a different stack height, might have a heel to toe that's more aggressive or less aggressive, You know, that sort of stuff. So when I change from so I have a trail blade which has less – it's less aggressive. The actual so running blades are like a J. They're shaped like a J, and they're either attached on the bottom of the socket or on the back of the socket where your calf muscle usually is. Now the J is positioned so when you hit the bottom of the J, it obviously bends towards your knee, and then as you maneuver your body forward, it propels you forward. So the bigger the J or the bigger the curve out the back, the more energy return you get. Yet when you run trails, you have hills and you go downhills, and usually you can't have a bow out the back that's more than 15 degrees. So my road blade is different than my trail blade, but you still want the same energy return. And they're on different sockets, and then I have another blade that I use that's quite aggressive that comes from the bottom of the socket. So I have three different running blades.
Would you have different for uphill and downhill?
Not necessarily, because you going uphill doesn't really matter. You would want the one that has the most energy return, because then when you load it up, it's propelling you forward.
But surely that could be problematic if the angle of the climb isn't right.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's very varying, obviously, grades that you go up and down, but you just got to manage it. It's it's quite similar to an able-bodied athlete possibly choosing the wrong shoes with bad grip, you know, when you start going up and downhill, you know. It's so for me, I have a leg runner that we change legs usually depending on the terrain I'm running on or the gradients of the elevation up and down. And that's obviously, you know, now very honed since heading out to Chamonix for UTMB last August, which was, you know, an absolute eye-opener for me for what incline is. You know, like people talk about sky running, and in Australia, you know, Kosciuszko is our biggest mountain at 2,200 metres. You sort of you go to the Alps and you're sort of staying in the middle of Chamonix and you just look up and you're like, my God, and, you know, I'm running up that sort of stuff. So it was a very, very good, you know, I went for 3 weeks before the race, which really helped me hone my leg choices, you know, and really worked on my downhill mobility. I wouldn't call it running. I call it more mountain goat skipping, you know.
How does your speed downhill compare relative to your speed uphill? Is it similar to an able-bodied runner, or?
It would depend on the incline. So with I completed OCC, and with the terrain, they changed the course. So it was quite, the first three quarters was all the elevation, and the last quarter was downhill. The last 8K was downhill, and I sort of managed to keep a 7.5 minute K on the last 8Ks going downhill because I'd managed to conserve enough going up. It really all depends on the day because the stump also swells and shrinks inside its socket. And there's no rhyme or reason. Like everyone says, oh yeah, hot it would swell, cold it would shrink. I'm like, no, it's not like that. It actually depends on the pounding that it takes the stump. So if your cadence is too high, then the stump is actually reacting too much and there's too much blood pooling in the bottom and can't, the venous return's not getting back out. So you have to take it out and let it swell and then push it back in and keep going, you know. But, you know, I didn't watch it that closely because the goal was to finish the race under the cutoff. I ended up finishing in sort of 12 hours and 50 odd minutes, which I was really stoked with, really happy with. But it was a huge learning curve on what an individual has to do in the Alps, like in proper mountain running. Whereas, you know, I feel in Australia, we kind of do more trail running, you know, and a lot of the races in America, they're more runnable events. Whereas you start getting into Europe and it's, you know, if you're the top 5%, you're running, but most of us are hiking, you know, and then skipping downhill. I love the downhill because I feel that my blade is able to, I'm able to control my blade going downhill better than I am going uphill, you know, with the skipping and the slalom techniques that I use going downhill.
And are the rules adapted to, because depending on the race, some races you have to, if you start with poles, for example, you start with equipment, you have to finish the equipment. Are there adjustments made to make it easier for people to have more than one blade, for example?
Yeah, well, I was the first amputee that finished any race at the UTMB finals. So there was a lot of reluctance. There was another above knee amputee that did the MCC, and he had a lot of trouble with them trying to get him off the course because they thought he was a danger, he was not going to finish in time, and so forth. So, you know,
are they worried about insurance then, or about claims, or about just how it looks for them, or?
Yeah, I think it's a type of ignorance. As in, when I say ignorance, I'm not talking about ignorance like, you know, you're ignorant. It's more the they haven't seen it before, and if you haven't seen it, you can't do it. Well, they didn't know if you could do it, and they weren't up for working with us to allow us more time. So what we ended up negotiating was that we would get the entire 14 hours, but not we would not have to reach cutoffs.
Okay, so have you, and is that because the speed of the ups and downs are different?
The speed of the ups and downs are different. However, this was with the inclusions manager at UTMB, yet they didn't. That wasn't then communicated to the volunteers manager or the checkpoint managers. So we then had problems out on course, and we had problems out on course with them even saying that if your pacer comes into the checkpoint, you're disqualified.
Okay. Yeah, and they put your leg.
Exactly. So it's like, and it was very, very, there was a lot of extra stress that was put on us, you know, for this, because we had been working with the people in the office about setting up a proper inclusion program that amputees can participate in these events, and then down the track other disabilities, because there are, you know, the vision impaired, autistic, you know, amputees alike, we all can be participating in trail running and not necessarily going to the UTMB finals, because there's other smaller events. But, you know, myself, after doing 200s and a 50 and running it fast enough to qualify, you know, I wanted to put my best foot forward. I'm coming from Australia to Europe. It's a big trip. And after working with them to say that we can have a leg carrier, they won't disqualify me if I get my leg from my pacer or my leg carrier, you know. But then on the course, it was totally different. So there was an extra layer of stress on the course, because you're always looking over your shoulder about what you're doing or who's going to come to you. And there was a number of times that, you know, my colleague who ran the MCC at one of the checkpoints, they were chasing him with scissors. And the sweeps were so close to him that they actually pushed his guide runner, that actually pushed him, and he nearly toppled, you know, down one of the inclines. So, you know, we have worked with them, and now there's actually a committee of amputees that is working with UTMB to I guess, better equip themselves for the finals in Chamonix. It's not actually going to other races.
So every race that I go to, Do you think it's a case of overzealous individual stewards, for example, or do you think it's more that there's, say, an arrogance to the organisational structure that means volunteers adopt a "we know best" default?
I would also say that it's culture. You know, in France themselves, they call the disabled organisations handy sport. You know, they don't call it adaptive. They don't even call disabilities. You know, when I crossed the line, I was like, and here's Troy, the first handy sport athlete. And I'm like, what's handy sport? You know, and I'm glad they've got the Paralympic Games this year, because that will help sort of spread some knowledge about individuals with disabilities. I also think too, it's sort of, they haven't seen it before. And the athletes that they have seen, they're only running 10 or 15 kilometers. They're not running the 55, the 100 or the milers, you know, where a couple of, you know, a couple of amputees are heading. You know, there's a couple of amputees in the US that have run some milers a decade ago, and now there's some new guys that we're trying to get together to get a group of us, because I've never raced anyone yet. Like I want to know what happens to my brain when I race someone. Like, I think right now I just race the clock, and I have a plan and I stick to my plan. But when someone's on you, or you're leading, or you're chasing, hunting someone, you know, I want to know what that does to my brain. Cause I wonder if basketball Troy comes back into the picture, you know, or I wonder that if I've actually grown and my self-growth has allowed me to still run my personal best, or I blow myself up in chasing someone.
So do you think there is space for organizations to actually be inclusive when, I mean, you're coming at this as having been a previously world-class athlete who knows how to train and is clearly very good physically. And whereas you get to 100-mile distance, and the difference in speed between an adaptive runner and a non-adaptive runner. You know, you're someone who would be naturally far faster than the average person who is an amputee. Do you think that actually these races have the ability to welcome all amputees without massively extending the cutoff times?
Yeah, see, I'm actually advocating for not extending the extending the overall time. You know, I think if a race has an overall time, it has an overall time for many reasons that runners need. I think organisers need to educate them. You know, insurance, daytime, that sort of stuff. You know, I think extending the cutoffs, there still needs to be an understanding of saying, well, if you're in a 50K race and you get the 25K and you've only got 4 hours left, well, you're not going to make the finish. So that common sense always needs to prevail, whether you're dealing with disabilities or not. There is 100% room to have adaptive sections in all trail running of UTMB and the World Trail Series and the Solomon Sky Racing. It's a no-brainer because having an amputee run your race, and I'm only going to speak for me being an amputee. I'm not going to speak for vision impaired or autistic. I think having an amputee run your race is there's usually a qualification period to get into races that I'm racing. You either have to have a certain marathon time or you have to have finished a 50K to go in 100K. So I've done all those previously. So I'm qualifying for races as my able-bodied counterparts would. I think there's actually a pathway to be able to have your adaptive runners reach those pathways because I've never finished last in a race. And I see amputees having kind of an advantage with their blades and their running. You know, it's all about trying to do your personal best. So at these big races, there's no reason why they can't have adapted areas because the athletes that want to race or run at these events, they've already done smaller events. I think what needs to be done is we need to educate the race directors about what amputees need. And then also we need to educate the amputees to say, hey, I think you're reaching too far too soon. Have you tried this event and this event?
That's what
I'm trying to do. I'm trying to raise my awareness within my community to say, hey, reach out. I'm happy to point you in the right direction. There's a number of other amputees around the world that are trying to do the same.
And the way the UTMB system is moving is that fewer and fewer middle back of the pack are getting places. And you could see a time when actually it's only people who've qualified by winning certain or very lucky in the lottery. Given how few amputee runners there are, and also the fact they're naturally going to be further back in the field, do you think that actually UTMB should be at least putting aside specific places for amputee runners in their finals, as long as they're quick enough to finish within the time?
So what they've done is they've created, UTMB have created an inclusion policy after my run and Zach's run, and then there was an arm amputee that ran my OCC. Now he knocked the race off in 6.5 hours. Like he's actually in some of the races in the US, he's placed. You know, he's finished on the podium, so he can run. And so what I feel that the inclusion policy, what UTMB have released is they will reserve 10 spots in every race for adaptive runners. As long as you have one, is it Cookie or is it
Stone? Yeah.
You know, one Stone. So as long as you have one Stone, you then email the inclusions officer and then they look at your credentials on however they do it, you know, and you can get in. But my thing is that if you haven't done, so I could now apply for the miler, but I've never done a miler. I've only done 100K. But able-bodied individuals, to get into the miler with a lottery, you only have to do 100K. But for an amputee, I kind of think that that's just insane because I think it's stretching 64 point something kilometers too far. too soon. So, you know, my plan is in February.
And are you limiting that to protect the individuals or to almost not bring the stats massively up of failure rates that then puts back the cause of having people in the races?
No, I don't really care about the failure or the stats. What I care about is having athletes with a disability being able to participate at the highest level, but they also are at the highest level, because you can't just show up at the Super Bowl or you can't just show up at the FA Cup final. You've got to work your way to get to the top races if you want to be a trail runner. And there are hundreds of other races that you can work on and work on your craft to perform a pathway. And I think that's also an education that needs to go out there. Like, you shouldn't, even able-bodied runners, they very rarely get into UTMB the final at Chamonix on their first run. But, you know, and we are talking a lot about UTMB, but there are so many other trail races that you can hone your craft and hone your distance and hone your skill before you step up to the Super Bowl of trail running, you know. And it's similar to a Hard Rock or a Western States or a Leadville. You know, last year at Leadville, they had 12 adapted runners and no one made it past 60 miles because of the cutoffs.
Mm.
You know, but the very famous runner that before he was an amputee, Dave Mackey, you know, Dave Mackey was an amputee and he placed at these races and then became an amputee from a trail accident. And he's also completed Leadville under the cutoff. So it's not to say that amputees can't do it, but in every sport that you do, there's the elite, and then there's the very good, then there's the good, then there's the average. And I think that, you know, I think there's too many amputees that want to show up at the biggest and most prestigious events without doing the work or putting in the time like our able-bodied counterparts have done.
And do you think, given that the 12 places arguably could be quite a lot versus the number of people who actually qualify, but then there will come a time when it won't be a lot. And do you think these places should be a lottery system, or should they go to the fastest amputees to create an actual race?
I think in 4 to 5 years that there'll be actually a tour for amputees. I think if it's not UTMB, it'll be, if it's not UTMB and Ironman, it'll be the World Trail Series or like Solomon have recruited a couple of amputee runners to run in some of their events in the World Trail Series. I think in, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, there'll be actually a tour for amputee runners, because it's becoming popular and there's people popping up now. There's ex-Paralympians that are starting to hear about it and jump on board and do it. And also, trail running is a sport that you can do, you know, later in life. You know, it's not necessarily a young man's game or young woman's game. You know, and people that acquire a disability, they might acquire it later in life. So I think that it's going the way of, you know, of there will be more professional trail runners, amputees. And there's, you know, there was a race this year, Tarawera in New Zealand, Rotorua.
Mm.
And they had a week before, they had their first adaptive trail race. So there was 26 amputees that came and they raced around the track. In December this year, I'll be putting one on in the Blue Mountains, where I'm actually encouraging electric wheelchairs, manual wheelchairs. We call them running walkers, so individuals with cerebral palsy that use a walker to come, and it's more of a flatter terrain. And then the following year, we'll actually have a tougher sort of track for the amputee.
Yeah.
So I think that these events, you know, and there's Born to Adapt in the US, so these events will start popping up and recruiting more people with disabilities to introduce them to trail running and the great meditative, or the meditative state that you get from running on the trail, and the medicinal benefits that you get from being outside in the bush. You know, it's sort of trail running saved my life from from post-basketball into the transition to trail running. You know, being a professional athlete, you was undergoing a lot of therapy, and as soon as I started trail running, it sort of all just melted away. You know, it all just melted away. So, you know, I love it. I love being in the open. I love being in the bush. I love adventuring and trail running.
And do you think you'll be the first amputee to finish ETMB? And if not, when do you think the year that someone finished it will be?
Well, last year they had a tremendous female athlete named Amy Palawato, I think.
Oh, yeah. We've interviewed Amy before. Yeah.
Well, she was in UTMB Mila last year. But she got canned at 106 kilometres. They said that she wasn't able to make the checkpoint. So, again, another wasn't able to make the checkpoint. I'm like, well, no, because we negotiated to have the entire race span. So, of course, you're not going to make the checkpoint, which is 8 kilometres, and you've got to do 1,000 metres of vert. Yet coming downhill, you're going to actually traverse at a different speed and you're going to make up that time. So this is the education that we're trying to give. I know she's actually trying Western States this year. So for me, it's more about learning. I'll do my first mile in next February at Tarawera, New Zealand. And once I've clicked my first miler over, I know that I can do the training that needed. I need to get between 80 and 120K a week running. And I can top out at 100, but then I need to go back down to 60 and then work my way back up. I can't maintain that status with my stump at the moment. So more training to do for the old boy. I'd like to be the first, but if I'm not going to be the first, then I'll aim to be the fastest, or I'll aim to complete it. Because again, yes, you know, if you don't see it, you can't do it. But then again, too, you know, we need more sponsors to get on board with Adapted Athletes, because, you know, it's a marketer's dream to have an amputee running in your product or on a billboard, because people double take. You know, no matter, I double take at disabilities, because I'm like, oh, what leg is he using, or what wheelchair are they using, or how do they look, or some, you know. So it's all about the education and the exposure that we can give other kids with disabilities, to give them options, because when I was a kid, I didn't have options, and that's what we need to do.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, and also good luck with all of the work to try and get these organizations to be as inclusive as possible, but also to actually spread that amongst their participants as well, and throughout the whole trail running community, because it sounds as if actually the community need to raise their awareness to be able to allow people to have that time to finish. And if you ever make it to the UK, let us know. We'd love to go for a run with you. And similarly, if I make it to Sydney, which I'm sure I will at some point, I will be giving you a bell.
And thanks, sir. Thanks for being what I call an enabler. You know, you're enabling myself to get the message out, and it's props to you. Thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Troy. There you go, Dubellas. Interesting conversation. We weren't sure. We chatted before it started, because we weren't sure where to steer it or how to almost introduce the journey to get to where Troy is now. And there's obviously a lot of other things we're going to talk about, particularly that redefining who you are post-sport. I think it's very common for people to come out of professional sport and to really feel lost. But also, there's some challenges there with whether there should be a lottery in the future. And I think Troy's view that just because you qualify for UTMB doesn't mean you should necessarily run it if you haven't done 100 mile before. And that might come up with some resistance from the community potentially. But if you like this episode, some other episodes that would be good to listen to. He's already mentioned Amy. We interviewed Amy Winters, episode 481, and she was talking about how amputee world records, but also to do with the lack of provision for amputee runners and amputee individuals in America, and what America can do to try and readdress that. Really good episode. I'm talking about battling to kind of overcome the physicality of these long endurance events. Another good episode was 492, which was Chris and Nick Nikic, who he's a runner with Down syndrome who has finished an Ironman, which was phenomenal to hear about just what he had to go through to adapt his chair, his real battle through the pain, and he was hilarious as well. So a really good episode to listen to. If there's any other guests you'd like us to interview, any suggestions or topics, then message me, david@badboyrunning.com, or spam us on Instagram, and we will see you next time. But a bye 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 bye, but a bye 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 bye.
Baby, come back. But a bye 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 bye, but a bye 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 bye. I must admit I was a clone to be messing around, but that doesn't mean that you have to leave town. Come back, yes, and give me one more try, 'cause a love like this should I never ever die. Come back.
Fuck you, buddy.